using the pronouns I and you in conversation, they may lack a mature enough mental self-representation to understand the distinction. This hypothesis would predict that even otherwise high-functioning autistics who can talk normally, highly verbal autistics are said to have Asperger syndrome, a subtype among autistic spectrum disorders, would have difficulty with such conceptual distinctions between words such as self-esteem, pity, mercy, forgiveness, and embarrassment, not to mention self-pity, which would make little sense without a full-fledged sense of self. Such predictions have never been tested on a systematic basis, but my student Laura Case is doing so. And we will return to these questions about self-representation and self-awareness and derangements of these elusive faculties in the last chapter. This may be a good place to add three qualifying remarks. First, small groups of cells with mirror neuron-like properties are found in many parts of the brain and should really be thought of as parts of a large interconnected circuit, a mirror network, if you will. Second, as I noted earlier, we must be careful not to attribute all puzzling aspects about the brain to mirror neurons. They don't do everything. Nonetheless, they seem to have been key players in our transcendence of apehood, and they keep turning up in study after study of various mental functions that go far beyond our original monkey-see-monkey-do conception of them. Third, ascribing certain cognitive capacities to certain neurons, in this case mirror neurons, or brain regions, is only a beginning. We still need to understand how the neurons carry out their computations. However, understanding the anatomy can substantially guide the way and help reduce the complexity of the problem. In particular, anatomical data can constrain our theoretical speculations and help eliminate many initially promising hypotheses. On the other hand, saying that mental capacities emerge in a homogeneous network gets you nowhere and flies in the face of empirical evidence of the exquisite anatomical specialization in the brain. Diffuse networks capable of learning exist in pigs and apes as well, but only humans are capable of language and self-reflection. Autism is still very difficult to treat, but the discovery of mirror neuron dysfunction opens up some novel therapeutic approaches. For example, the lack of mu wave suppression could become an invaluable diagnostic tool for screening for the disorder in early infancy, so that currently available behavioral therapies can be instituted long before other, more florid symptoms appear. Unfortunately, in most cases, it is the unfolding of the florid symptoms during the second or third year of life that tips parents and doctors off. The earlier autism is caught, the better. A second, more intriguing possibility would be to use biofeedback to treat the disorder. In biofeedback, a physiological signal from a subject's body or brain is tracked by a machine and represented back to the subject through some sort of external display. The goal is for the subject to concentrate on nudging that signal up or down and thereby gain some measure of conscious control over it. For example, a biofeedback system can show a person his heart rate, represented as a bouncing, beeping dot on a display screen. Most people, with practice, can use this feedback to learn how to slow their hearts at will. Brain waves can also be used for biofeedback. For example, Stanford University professor Sean Mackey put chronic pain patients in a brain imaging scanner and showed them a computer-animated image of a flame. The size of the flame at any given moment was a representation of the neural activity in each patient's anterior cingulate, a cortical region involved in pain perception, and was thus proportional to the subjective amount of pain he or she was in. By concentrating on the flame, most of the patients were able to gain some control over its size and to keep it small, and ipso facto, to reduce the amount of pain they were experiencing. By the same token, one could monitor mu waves on an autistic child's scalp and display them on a screen in front of her, perhaps in the guise of a simple, thought-controlled video game, to see if she can somehow learn to suppress them. Assuming her mirror neuron function is weak or dormant rather than absent, this kind of exercise might boost her ability to see through the intentionality of others and bring her a step closer to joining the social world that swirls invisibly around her. As this book went to press, this approach was being pursued by our colleague Jamie Pineda at UC San Diego. A third possibility, one that I suggested in an article for Scientific American that I co-authored with my graduate student Lindsay Oberman, would be to try certain drugs. There is a great deal of anecdotal evidence that MDMA, the party drug ecstasy, enhances empathy, which it may do by increasing the abundance of neurotransmitters called empathogens, which naturally occur in the brains of highly social creatures, such as primates. Could a deficiency in such transmitters contribute to the symptoms of autism? If so, could MDMA, with its molecules suitably modified, ameliorate some of the most troubling symptoms of the disorder? It is also known that prolactin and oxytocin, so-called affiliation hormones, promote social bonding. Perhaps this connection, too, could be exploited therapeutically. If administered sufficiently early, cocktails of such drugs might help tide over some early symptom manifestations enough to minimize the subsequent cascade of events that lead to the full spectrum of autistic symptoms. Speaking of prolactin and oxytocin, we recently encountered an autistic child whose brain MRI showed a substantial reduction in the size of the olfactory bulb, which receives smell signals from the nose. Given that smell is a major factor in the regulation of social behavior in most mammals, we wondered, is it conceivable that olfactory bulb malfunction plays a major role in the genesis of autism? Reduced olfactory bulb activity could diminish oxytocin and prolactin, which in turn might reduce empathy and compassion. Needless to say, this is all pure speculation on my part, but in science, fancy is often the mother of fact, at least often enough that premature censorship of speculation is never a good idea. One final option for reviving dormant mirror neurons in autism would be to take advantage of the great delight that all humans, including autistics, take in dancing to a rhythm. Although such dance therapy using rhythmic music has been tried with autistic children, no attempt has been made to directly tap into the known properties of the mirror neuron system. One way to do this might be, for example, to have several model dancers moving simultaneously to rhythm and having the child mime the same dance in synchrony. Immersing all of them in a hall of multiply reflecting mirrors might also help by multiplying the impact on the mirror neuron system. It seems like a far-fetched possibility, but then so was the idea of using vaccines to prevent rabies or diphtheria. The mirror neuron hypothesis does a good job of accounting for the defining features of autism: lack of empathy, pretend play, imitation, and a theory of mind. However, it is not a complete account, because there are some other common, though not defining, symptoms of autism that mirror neurons do not have any apparent bearing on. For example, some autistics display a rocking to-and-fro movement, avoid eye contact, show hypersensitivity and aversion to certain sounds, and often engage in tactile self-stimulation, sometimes even beating themselves, which seems intended to dampen this hypersensitivity. These symptoms are common enough that they too need to be explained in any full account of autism. Perhaps beating themselves is a way of enhancing the salience of the body, thereby helping anchor the self and reaffirming its existence. But can we put this idea in the context of the rest of what we have said so far about autism? In the early 1990s, our group, in collaboration with Bill Hurstein, my postdoctoral colleague, and Portia Iverson, co-founder of Cure Autism Now, an organization devoted to autism, thought a lot about how to account for these other symptoms of autism. We came up with what we called the salience landscape theory. When a person looks at the world, she is confronted with a potentially bewildering sensory overload. As we saw in Chapter 2, when we considered the two branches of the what stream in the visual cortex, information about the world is first discriminated in the brain's sensory areas and then relayed to the amygdala. As the gateway to the emotional core of your brain, the amygdala performs an emotional surveillance of the world you inhabit, gauges the emotional significance of everything you see, and decides whether it is trivial and humdrum or something worth getting emotional over. If the latter, the amygdala tells the hypothalamus to activate the autonomic nervous system in proportion to the arousal worthiness of the triggering sight. It could be anything from mildly interesting to downright terrifying. Thus, the amygdala is able to create a salience landscape of your world with hills and valleys corresponding to high and low salience. It is sometimes possible for this circuit to go haywire. Your autonomic response to something arousing manifests as increased sweating, heart rate, muscular readiness, and so on, to prepare your body for action. In extreme cases, this surge of physiological arousal can feed back into your brain and prompt your amygdala to say, in effect, "Wow, it's even more dangerous than I thought. We'll need more arousal to get out of this." The result is an autonomic blitzkrieg. Many adults are prone to such panic attacks, but most of us, most of the time, are not in danger of getting swept away by such autonomic maelstroms. With all this in mind, our group explored the possibility that children with autism have a distorted salience landscape. This may be partially due to indiscriminately enhanced or reduced connections between sensory cortices and the amygdala, and possibly between limbic structures and the frontal lobes. As a result of these abnormal connections, every trivial event or object sets off an uncontrollable autonomic storm, which would explain autistics' preference for sameness and routine. If the emotional arousal is less florid, on the other hand, the child might attach abnormally high significance to certain unusual stimuli, which could account for their strange preoccupations, including their sometimes savant-like skills. Conversely, if some of the connections from the sensory cortex to the amygdala are partially effaced by the distortions in salience landscape, the child might ignore things, like eyes, that most normal children find highly attention-grabbing. To test the salience landscape hypothesis, we measured galvanic skin response, GSR, in a group of 37 autistic and 25 normal children. The normal children showed arousal for certain categories of stimuli, as expected, but not for others. For example, they had GSR responses to photos of parents, but not of pencils. The children with autism, on the other hand, showed a more generally heightened autonomic arousal that was further amplified by the most trivial objects and events, whereas some highly salient stimuli, such as eyes, were completely ineffective. If salience landscape theory is on the right track, one would expect to find abnormalities in visual pathway 3 of autistic brains. Pathway 3 not only projects to the amygdala, but it routes through the superior temporal sulcus, which, along with its neighboring region, the insula, is rich in mirror neurons. In the insula, mirror neurons have been shown to be involved in perceiving as well as expressing certain emotions, like disgust, including social and moral disgust, in an empathic manner. Thus, damage to these areas, or perhaps a deficiency of mirror neurons within them, might not only distort the salience landscape, but also diminish empathy, social interaction, imitation, and pretend play. As an added bonus, salience landscape theory may also explain two other quirky aspects of autism that have always been puzzling. First, some parents report that their child's autistic symptoms are temporarily relieved by a bout of high fever. Fever is ordinarily caused by certain bacterial toxins that act on temperature-regulating mechanisms in the hypothalamus, in the base of your brain. Again, this is part of pathway 3. I realized that it may not be coincidental that certain dysfunctional behaviors, such as tantrums, originate in networks that neighbor the hypothalamus. Thus, the fever might have a spillover effect that happens to dampen activity at one of the bottlenecks of the feedback loop that generates those autonomic arousal storms and their associated tantrums. This is a highly speculative explanation, but it's better than none at all, and if it pans out, it could provide another basis for intervention. For example, there might be some way to safely dampen the feedback loop artificially. A damped circuit might be better than a malfunctioning one, especially if it could get a kid like Stephen to engage even just a little bit more with his mother. For example, one could give him high fever harmlessly by injecting denatured malarial parasites. Repeated injections of such pyrogens, fever-inducing substances, might help reset the circuit and alleviate symptoms permanently. Second, children with autism often repeatedly bang and beat themselves. This behavior is called somatic self-stimulation. In terms of our theory, we would suggest that this leads to a damping of the autonomic arousal storms that the child suffers from. Indeed, our research team has found that such self-stimulation not only has a calming effect, but leads to a measurable reduction in GSR. This suggests a possible symptomatic therapy for autism. One could have a portable device for monitoring GSR that then feeds back to a body stimulation device which the child wears under his clothing. Whether such a device would prove practical in a day-to-day setting remains to be seen. It is being tested by my postdoctoral colleague, Bill Herstein. The to-and-fro rocking behavior of some autistic children may serve a similar purpose. We know it likely stimulates the vestibular system, sense of balance, and we know that balance-related information splits at some point to travel down pathway 3, especially to the insula. Thus, repetitive rocking might provide the same kind of damping that self-beating does. More speculatively, it might help anchor the self in the body, providing coherence to an otherwise chaotic world, as I'll describe in a moment. Aside from possible mirror neuron deficiency, what other factors might account for the distorted salience landscapes through which many autistic people seem to view the world? It is well documented that there are genetic predispositions to autism, but less well known is the fact that nearly a third of children with autism have had temporal lobe epilepsy, TLE, in infancy. The proportion could be much higher if we include clinically undetected complex partial seizures. In adults, TLE manifests as florid emotional disturbances, but because their brains are fully mature, it does not appear to lead to deep-seated cognitive distortions. But less is known about what TLE does to a developing brain. TLE seizures are caused by repeated random volleys of nerve impulses coursing through the limbic system. If they occur frequently in a very young brain, they might lead, through a process of synapse enhancement called kindling, to selective but widespread indiscriminate enhancement, or sometimes effacement, of the connections between the amygdala and the high-level visual, auditory, and somatosensory cortices. This could account both for the frequent false alarms set off by trivial or mundane sights and otherwise neutral sounds, and conversely, for the failure to react to socially salient information, which are so characteristic of autism. In more general terms, our sense of being an integrated, embodied self seems to depend crucially on back-and-forth, echo-like reverberation between the brain and the rest of the body, and indeed, thanks to empathy, between the self and others. Indiscriminate scramblings of the connections between high-level sensory areas and the amygdala, and the resulting distortions to one's salience landscape, could, as part of the same process, cause a disturbing loss of this sense of embodiment, of being a distinct, autonomous self anchored in a body and embedded in a society. Perhaps somatic self-stimulation is some children's attempt to regain their embodiment by reviving and enhancing body-brain interactions while at the same time damping spuriously amplified autonomic signals. A subtle balance of such interactions may be crucial for the normal development of an integrated self, something we ordinarily take for granted as the axiomatic foundation of being a person. No wonder, then, that this very sense of being a person is profoundly disturbed in autism. We have so far considered two candidate theories for explaining the bizarre symptoms of autism: the mirror neuron dysfunction hypothesis and the idea of a distorted salience landscape. The rationale for proposing these theories is to provide unitary mechanisms for the bewildering array of seemingly unrelated symptoms that characterize the disorder. Of course, the two hypotheses are not necessarily mutually exclusive. Indeed, there are known connections between the mirror neuron system and the limbic system. It is possible that distortions in limbic sensory connections are what lead ultimately to a deranged mirror neuron system. Clearly, we need more experiments to resolve these issues. Whatever the underlying mechanisms turn out to be, our results strongly suggest that children with autism have a dysfunctional mirror neuron system that may help explain many features of the syndrome. Whether this dysfunction is caused by genes concerned with brain development or by genes that predispose to certain viruses that in turn might predispose to seizures, or is due to something else entirely, remains to be seen. Meanwhile, it might provide a useful jumping-off point for future research into autism, so that someday we may find a way to bring Stephen back. Autism reminds us that the uniquely human sense of self is not an airy nothing without habitation and a name. Despite its vehement tendency to assert its privacy and independence, the self actually emerges from a reciprocity of interactions with others and with the body it is embedded in. When it withdraws from society and retreats from its own body, it barely exists, at least not in the sense of a mature self that defines our existence as human beings. Indeed, autism could be regarded fundamentally as a disorder of self-consciousness, and if so, research on this disorder may help us understand the nature of consciousness itself. Chapter 6: The Power of Babel, The Evolution of Language. Thoughtful men, once escaped from the blinding influences of traditional prejudice, will find in the lowly stock whence man has sprung the best evidence of the splendor of his capacities, and will discern in his long progress through the past a reasonable ground of faith in his attainment of a nobler future. Thomas Henry Huxley. On the long 4th of July weekend of 1999, I received a phone call from John Hamdi, who had been a colleague of mine at Trinity College, Cambridge, nearly 15 years earlier. We hadn't been in contact, and it was a pleasant surprise to hear his voice after such a long time. As we exchanged greetings, I smiled to myself, reminded of the many adventures we had shared during our student days. He was now a professor of orthopedic surgery in Bristol, he said. He had noticed a book I'd recently published. "I know you are mainly involved in research these days," he said, "but my father, who lives in La Jolla, has had a head injury from a skiing accident, followed by a stroke. His right side is paralyzed, and I'd be grateful if you could take a look at him. I want to make sure he's getting the best treatment available. I heard there's a new rehab procedure which employs mirrors to help patients recover the use of a paralyzed arm. Do you know anything about this?" A week later, John's father, Dr. Hamdi, was brought to my office by his wife. He had been a world-renowned professor of chemistry here at UC San Diego until his retirement 3 years earlier. About 6 months prior to my seeing him, he sustained a skull fracture. In the emergency room at Scripps Clinic, he was informed that a stroke, caused by a blood clot in his middle cerebral artery, had cut off the blood supply to the left hemisphere of his brain. Since the left hemisphere controls the right side of the body, Dr. Hamdi's right arm and leg were paralyzed. Much more alarming than the paralysis, though, was the fact that he could no longer speak fluently. Even simple requests, such as "I want water," required great effort, and we had to pay careful attention to understand what he was saying. Assisting me in examining Dr. Hamdi was Jason Alexander, a medical student on a 6-month rotation in our lab. Jason and I looked at Dr. Hamdi's charts and also obtained a medical history from Mrs. Hamdi. We then conducted a routine neurological workup, testing in sequence his motor functions, sensory functions, reflexes, cranial nerves, and his higher mental functions such as memory, language, and intelligence. I took the handle of my knee hammer and, while Dr. Hamdi was lying in bed, stroked the outer border of his right foot and then the left foot, running the tip of the hammer handle from the pinky to sole. Nothing much happened in the normal foot, but when I repeated the procedure on the paralyzed right foot, the big toe instantly curled upward and all the other toes fanned out. This is Babinski's sign, arguably the most famous sign in neurology. It reliably indicates damage to the pyramidal tracts, the great motor pathway that descends from the motor cortex down into the spinal cord, conveying commands for volitional movements. "Why does the toe go up?" asked Jason. "We don't know," I said, "but one possibility is that it's a throwback to an early stage in evolutionary history. The reflexive withdrawal tendency for the toes to fan out and curl up is seen in lower mammals. But the pyramidal tracts in primates become especially pronounced, and they inhibit this primitive reflex. Primates have a more sophisticated grasp reflex, with a tendency for the toes to curl inward, as if to clutch a branch. It may be a reflex to avoid falling out of trees." "Sounds far-fetched," said Jason, skeptically. "But when the pyramidal tracts are damaged," I said, ignoring his remark, "the grasp reflex goes away, and the more primitive withdrawal reflex emerges, because it's no longer inhibited. That's why you also see it in infants. Their pyramidal tracts haven't fully developed yet." The paralysis was bad enough, but Dr. Hamdi was more troubled by his speech impediment. He had developed a language deficit called Broca's aphasia, named after the French neurologist Paul Broca, who first described the syndrome in 1865. The damage is usually in the left frontal lobe in a region, figure 6-1, that lies just in front of the large fissure or vertical furrow that separates the parietal and frontal lobes. Like most patients with this disorder, Dr. Hamdi could convey the general sense of what he was trying to say, but his speech was slow and effortful, conveyed in a flat monotone, filled with pauses, and almost completely devoid of syntax, loosely speaking, grammatical structure. His utterances were also deficient in, though not devoid of, so-called function words, such as and, but, and if, which don't refer to anything in the world, but specify relationships between different parts of a sentence. "Dr. Hamdi, tell me about your skiing accident," I said.
"Jackson, Wyoming," he began, "and skied down and, tumbled. All right. Gloves, mittens, poles, but the blood drained. 3 days pass, hospital, and, coma. 10 days. Switch to Sharp, Memorial Hospital. 4 months and back. It's, slow process and a bit of medicine. 6 medicines. 1 tried, 8 or 9 months.
Okay, continue.
And seizures.
Oh, where was the blood hemorrhage from?
Dr. Hamdi pointed to the side of his neck.
The carotid?
Yeah. But, this and this,
he said, using his left hand to point to multiple places on his right leg and arm.
Go on, I said. Tell us more.
It's difficult, referring to his paralysis, Left side perfectly okay.
Are you right-handed or left-handed?
Right-handed.
Can you write with the left now?
Yeah.
Okay, good. What about word processing?
Processing, right.
But when you write, is it slow?
Yeah.
Just like your speech?
Right.
When people talk fast, you have no problem understanding them?
Yeah.
You can understand?
Right.
Very good.
The speech, slowed down.
Okay. Do you think your speech is slowed down, or your thought is slowed down?
Okay. But,
points to head.
Words are beautiful. Speech.
He then made twisting motions with his mouth. Presumably he meant that his flow of thought felt intact, but the words were not coming out fluently. Supposing I ask you a question, I said. Mary and Joe, together, have 18 apples.
All right.
Joe has twice as many apples as Mary.
Okay.
So how many does Mary have? How many does Joe have?
Let me think. Oh, God.
Mary and Joe together have 18 apples.
12,
he blurted. Excellent. So Dr. Hamdi had basic conceptual algebra, was able to do simple arithmetic, and had good comprehension of language, even for relatively complex sentences. I was told he had been a superb mathematician before his accident. Yet later, when Jason and I tested Dr. Hamdi on more complex algebra, using symbols, he kept trying hard, but failing. I was intrigued by the possibility that the Broca's area might be specialized not just for the syntax or syntactic structure of natural language, but also for other more arbitrary languages that have formal rules, such as algebra or computer programming. Even though the area might have evolved for natural language, it may have the latent capacity for other functions that bear a certain resemblance to the rules of syntax. What do I mean by syntax? To understand Dr. Hamdi's main problem, consider a routine sentence such as, "I lent the book you gave me to Mary." Here an entire noun phrase, "the book you gave me," is embedded in a larger sentence. That embedding process, called recursion, is facilitated by function words and is made possible by a number of unconscious rules, rules that all languages follow, no matter how different they may seem on the surface. Recursion can be repeated any number of times to make a sentence as complex as it needs to be in order to convey its ideas. With each recursion, the sentence adds a new branch to its phrase structure. Our example sentence can be expanded, for instance, to, "I lent the book you gave me while I was in the hospital to Mary," and from there to, "I lent the book you gave me while I was in the hospital to a nice woman I met there named Mary," and so on. Syntax allows us to create sentences as complex as our short-term memory can handle. Of course, if we go on too long, it can get silly or start to feel like a game, as in the old English nursery rhyme, "This is the man all tattered and torn, that kissed the maiden all forlorn, that milked the cow with the crumpled horn, that tossed the dog, that worried the cat, that killed the rat, that ate the malt, that lay in the house that Jack built." Now, before we go on discussing language, we need to ask how we can be sure Dr. Hamdi's problem was really a disorder of language at its abstract level and not something more mundane. You might think, reasonably, that the stroke had damaged the parts of his cortex that control his lips, tongue, palate, and other small muscles required for the execution of speech. Because talking required such effort, he was economizing on words. The telegraphic nature of his speech may have been to save effort. But I did some simple tests to show Jason that this couldn't be the reason. Dr. Hamdi, can you write down on this pad the reason why you went to the hospital? What happened? Dr. Hamdi understood our request and proceeded to write, using his left hand, a long paragraph about the circumstances that brought him to our hospital. Although the handwriting wasn't good, the paragraph made sense. We could understand what he had written. Yet, remarkably, his writing also had poor grammatical structure. Too few ands, ifs, and buts. If his problem were related to speech muscles, why did his writing also have the same abnormal form as his speech? After all, there was nothing wrong with his left hand. I then asked Dr. Hamdi to sing Happy Birthday. He sang it effortlessly. Not only could he carry the tune well, but all the words were there and correctly pronounced. This was in stark contrast to his speech, which, in addition to missing important connecting words and lacking phrase structure, also contained mispronounced words and lacked the intonation, rhythm, and the melodious flow of normal speech. If his problem were poor control of his vocal apparatus, he shouldn't have been able to sing either. To this day, we don't know why Broca's patients can sing. One possibility is that language function is based mainly in the left hemisphere, which is damaged in these patients, whereas singing is done by the right hemisphere. We had already learned a great deal after just a few minutes of testing. Dr. Hamdi's problems with expressing himself were not caused by a partial paralysis or weakness of his mouth and tongue. He had a disorder of language, not of speech, and the two are radically different. A parrot can talk, it has speech, you might say, but it doesn't have language.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Human language seems so complex, multidimensional, and richly evocative that one is tempted to think that almost the entire brain, or large chunks of it at least, must be involved. After all, even the utterance of a single word like rose evokes a whole host of associations and emotions. The first rose you ever got, the fragrance, rose gardens you were promised, rosy lips and cheeks, thorns, rose-colored glasses, and so on. Doesn't this imply that many far-flung regions of the brain must cooperate to generate the concept of a rose? Surely the word is just the handle, or focus, around which swirls a halo of associations, meanings, and memories. There's probably some truth to this, but the evidence from aphasics such as Dr. Hamdi suggests the very opposite, that the brain has neural circuits specialized for language. Indeed, it may even be that separate components or stages of language processing are dealt with by different parts of the brain, although we should really think of them as parts of one large interconnected system. We are accustomed to thinking of language as a single function, but this is an illusion. Vision feels like a unitary faculty to us as well, yet, as noted in Chapter 2, seeing relies on numerous quasi-independent areas. Language is similar. A sentence, loosely speaking, has three distinct components, which are normally so closely interwoven that they don't feel separate. First, there are the building blocks we call words, lexicon, that denote objects, actions, and events. Second, there is the actual meaning, semantics, conveyed by the sentence. And third, there is syntactic structure, loosely speaking, grammar, which involves the use of function words and recursion. The rules of syntax generate the complex hierarchical phrase structure of human language, which at its core allows the unambiguous communication of fine nuances of meaning and intention. Human beings are the only creatures to have true language. Even chimps, who can be trained to sign simple sentences like, "Give me fruit," can't come close to complex sentences such as, "It's true that Joe is the big alpha male, but he's starting to get old and lazy, so don't worry about what he might do, unless he seems to be in an especially nasty mood." The seemingly infinite flexibility and open-endedness of our language is one of the hallmarks of the human species. In ordinary speech, meaning and syntactic structure are so closely intertwined that it's hard to believe that they are really distinct. But you can have a perfectly grammatical sentence that is meaningless gibberish, as in the linguist Noam Chomsky's famous example, "Colorless green ideas sleep furiously." Conversely, a meaningful idea can be conveyed adequately by a non-grammatical sentence, as Dr. Hamdi has shown us. "It's difficult, left side perfectly okay." It turns out that different parts of the brain are specialized for these three different aspects of language: lexicon, semantics, and syntax. But the agreement among researchers ends there. The degree of specialization is hotly debated. Language, more than any other topic, tends to polarize academics. I don't quite know why, but fortunately it isn't my field. In any case, by most accounts, Broca's area seems mainly concerned with syntactic structure. So Dr. Hamdi had no better chance than a chimp of generating long sentences full of hypotheticals and subordinate clauses. Yet he had no difficulty in communicating his ideas by just stringing words together in approximately the right order, like Tarzan, or surfer dudes in California. One reason for thinking that Broca's area is specialized exclusively for syntactic structure is the observation that it seems to have a life of its own, quite independent of the meaning conveyed. It's almost as though this patch of cortex has an autonomous set of grammatical rules that are intrinsic to its networks. Some of them seem quite arbitrary and apparently non-functional, which is the main reason linguists assert its independence from semantics and meaning and dislike thinking of it as having evolved from anything else in the brain. The extreme view is exemplified by Chomsky, who believes that it didn't even evolve through natural selection. The brain region concerned with semantics is located in the left temporal lobe near the back of the great horizontal cleft in the middle of the brain. See figure 6.1. This region, called Wernicke's area, appears to be specialized for the representation of meaning. Dr. Hamdi's Wernicke's area was obviously intact. He could still comprehend what was said to him and could convey some semblance of meaning in his conversations. Conversely, Wernicke's aphasia, what you get if your Wernicke's area is damaged but your Broca's area remains intact, is, in a sense, the mirror image of Broca's aphasia. The patient can fluently generate elaborate, smoothly articulated, grammatically flawless sentences, but it's all meaningless gibberish. At least, that's the official party line. But later, I'll provide evidence that this isn't entirely true. These basic facts about the major language-related brain areas have been known for more than a century, but many questions remain. How complete is the specialization? How does the neural circuitry within each area actually do its job? How autonomous are these areas, and how do they interact to generate smoothly articulated, meaningful sentences? How does language interact with thought? Does language enable us to think, or does thinking enable us to talk? Can we think in a sophisticated manner without silent internal speech? And lastly, how did this extraordinarily complex, multi-component system originally come into existence in our hominin ancestors? This last question is the most vexing. Our journey into full-blown humanity began with nothing but the primitive growls, grunts, and groans available to our primate cousins. By 75,000 to 150,000 years ago, the human brain was brimming with complex thoughts and linguistic skills. How did this happen? Clearly, there must have been a transitional phase, yet it's hard to imagine how linguistic brain structures of intermediate complexity might have worked, or what functions they might have served along the way. The transitional phase must have been at least partially functional, otherwise it couldn't have been selected for, nor served as an evolutionary bridge for the eventual emergence of more sophisticated language functions. To understand what this bridge might have been is the main purpose of this chapter. I should point out that by language, I don't mean just communication. We often use the two words interchangeably, but in fact they are very different. Consider the vervet monkey. Vervets have 3 alarm calls to alert each other about predators. The call for leopard prompts the troop to bolt for the nearest tree. The call for serpent causes the monkeys to stand up on 2 legs and peer down into the grass. And when vervets hear the eagle call, they look up into the air and seek shelter in the underbrush. It's tempting to conclude that these calls are like words, or at least the precursors to words, and that the monkey does have a primitive vocabulary of sorts. But do the monkeys really know there's a leopard? Or do they just rush for the nearest tree reflexively when an alarm call is sounded? Or perhaps the call really just means climb, or there's danger on the ground, rather than the much richer concept of leopard that a human brain harbors. This example tells us that mere communication isn't language. Like an air raid siren or a fire alarm, vervet's cries are generalized alerts that refer to specific situations. They are almost nothing like words. In fact, we can list a set of 5 characteristics that make human language unique and radically different from other types of communication we see in vervets or dolphins. 1. Our vocabulary, lexicon, is enormous. By the time a child is 8 years old, she has almost 600 words at her disposal, a figure that vastly exceeds the nearest runner-up, the vervet monkey, by 2 orders of magnitude. One could argue, though, that this is really a matter of degree than a qualitative jump. Maybe we just have much better memories. 2. More important than the sheer size of our lexicon is the fact that only humans have function words that exist exclusively in the context of language. While words like dog, night, or naughty refer to actual things or events, function words have no existence independent of their linguistic function. So even though a sentence such as, "If Gonpok is Buga, then Gadul will be too," is meaningless, we do understand the conditional nature of the statement because of the conventional usage of if and then. 3. Humans can use words offline, that is, to refer to things or events that are not currently visible or exist only in the past, the future, or a hypothetical reality. I saw an apple on the tree yesterday and decided I will pluck it tomorrow, but only if it is ripe. This type of complexity isn't found in most spontaneous forms of animal communication. Apes who are taught sign language can, of course, use signs in the absence of the object being referred to. For example, they can sign banana when hungry. 4. Only humans, as far as we know, can use metaphor and analogy, although here we are in a gray area, the elusive boundary between thought and language. When an alpha male ape makes a genital display to intimidate a rival into submission, is this analogous to the metaphor, "fuck you," that humans use to insult one another? I wonder. But even so, this limited kind of metaphor falls far short of puns and poems, or of Tagore's description of the Taj Mahal as a teardrop on the cheek of time. Here again is that mysterious boundary between language and thought. 5. Flexible, recursive syntax is found only in human language. Most linguists single out this feature to argue for a qualitative jump between animal and human communication, possibly because it has more regularities and can be tackled more rigorously than other, more nebulous aspects of language. These 5 aspects of language are, by and large, unique to humans. Of these, the first 4 are often lumped together as proto-language, a term invented by the linguist Derek Bickerton. As we'll see, proto-language set the stage for the subsequent emergence and culmination of a highly sophisticated system of interacting parts that we call, as a whole system, true language. 2 topics in brain research always seem to attract geniuses and crackpots. One is consciousness, and the other is the question of how language evolved. So many zany ideas on language origins were being proposed in the 19th century that the Linguistic Society of Paris introduced a formal ban on all papers dealing with this topic. The Society argued that, given the paucity of evolutionary intermediates, or fossil languages, the whole enterprise was doomed to fail. More likely, linguists of the day were so fascinated by the intricacies of rules intrinsic to language itself that they were not curious about how it may have all started. But censorship bans and negative predictions are never a good idea in science. A number of cognitive neuroscientists, myself included, believe that mainstream linguists have been overemphasizing the structural aspects of language, pointing to the fact that the mind's grammatical systems are, to a large extent, autonomous and modular. Most linguists have shunned the question of how these interact with other cognitive processes. They profess interest solely in the rules that are fundamental to the brain's grammatical circuits, not how the circuits actually work. This narrow focus removes the incentive to investigate how this mechanism interacts with other mental capacities, such as semantics, which orthodox linguists don't even regard as an aspect of language, or to ask evolutionary questions about how it might have evolved from pre-existing brain structures. The linguists can be forgiven, if not applauded, for their wariness of evolutionary questions. With so many interlocking parts working in such a coordinated manner, it's hard to figure out, or even imagine, how language could have evolved by the essentially blind process of natural selection. By natural selection, I mean the progressive accumulation of chance variations that enhance the organism's ability to pass on its genes to the next generation. It's not difficult to imagine a single trait, such as a giraffe's long neck, being a product of this relatively simple adaptive process. Giraffe ancestors that had mutant genes conferring slightly longer necks had better access to tree leaves, causing them to survive longer or breed more, which caused the beneficial genes to increase in number down through the generations. The result was a progressive increase in neck length. But how can multiple traits, each of which would be useless without the other, evolve in tandem? Many complex, interwoven systems in biology have been held up by would-be debunkers of evolutionary theory to argue for so-called intelligent design, the idea that the complexities of life could only occur through divine intervention or the hand of God. For example, how could the vertebrate eye evolve via natural selection? A lens and a retina are mutually necessary, so each would be useless without the other. Yet, by definition, the mechanism of natural selection has no foresight, so it couldn't have created the one in preparation for the other. Fortunately, as Richard Dawkins has pointed out, there are numerous creatures in nature with eyes at all stages of complexity. It turns out there is a logical evolutionary sequence that leads from the simplest possible light-sensing mechanism, a patch of light-sensitive cells on the outer skin, to the exquisite optical organ we enjoy today. Language is similarly complex, but in this case, we have no idea what the intermediate steps might have been. As the French linguists pointed out, there are no fossil languages or half-human creatures around for us to study. But this hasn't stopped people from speculating on how the transition might have come about. Broadly speaking, there have been four main ideas. Some of the confusion between these ideas results from failing to define language clearly in the narrow sense of syntax versus the broader sense that includes semantics. I will use the term in the broader sense. The first idea was advanced by Darwin's contemporary Alfred Russel Wallace, who independently discovered the principle of natural selection, though he rarely gets the credit he deserves, probably because he was Welsh rather than English. Wallace argued that while natural selection was fine for turning fins into feet or scales into hair, language was too sophisticated to have emerged in this way. His solution to the problem was simple. Language was put into our brains by God. This idea may or may not be right, but as scientists we can't test it, so let's move on. Second, there's the idea put forward by the founding father of modern linguistic science, Noam Chomsky. Like Wallace, he too was struck by the sophistication and complexity of language. Again, he couldn't conceive of natural selection being the correct explanation for how language evolved. Chomsky's theory of language origins is based on the principle of emergence. The word simply means the whole is greater, sometimes vastly so, than the mere sum of its parts. A good example would be the production of salt, an edible white crystal, by combining the pungent, greenish, poisonous gas chlorine with the shiny light metal sodium. Neither of these elements has anything salt-like about it, yet they combine into salt. Now, if such a complex, wholly unpredictable new property can emerge from a simple interaction between two elementary substances, then who can predict what novel, unforeseen properties might emerge when you pack 100 billion nerve cells into the tiny space of the human cranial cavity? Maybe language is one such property. Chomsky's idea isn't quite as silly as some of my colleagues think. But even if it's right, there's not much one can say or do about it, given the current state of brain science. There's simply no way of testing it. And although Chomsky doesn't speak of God, his idea comes perilously close to Wallace's. I don't know for sure that he is wrong, but I don't like the idea for the simple reason that one can't get very far in science by saying, in effect, something miraculous happened. I'm interested in finding a more convincing explanation that's based on the known principles of organic evolution and brain function. The third theory, proposed by one of the most distinguished exponents of evolutionary theory in this country, the late Stephen Jay Gould, argues that, contrary to what most linguists claim, language is not a specialized mechanism based on brain modules, and that it did not evolve specifically for its most obvious present purpose, communication. On the contrary, it represents the specific implementation of a more general mechanism that evolved earlier for other reasons, namely, thinking. In Gould's theory, language is rooted in a system that gave our ancestors a more sophisticated way to mentally represent the world, and, as we shall see in Chapter 9, a way to represent themselves within that representation. Only later did this system get repurposed or extended into a means of communication. In this view, then, thinking was an exaptation, a mechanism that originally evolved for one function and then provided the opportunity for something very different, in this case, language, to evolve. We need to bear in mind that the exaptation itself must have evolved by conventional natural selection. Failure to appreciate this has resulted in much confusion and bitter feuds. The principle of exaptation is not an alternative to natural selection, as Gould's critics believe, but actually complements and expands its scope and range of applicability. For instance, feathers originally evolved from reptilian scales as an adaptation to provide insulation, just like hair in mammals, but then were exapted for flight. Reptiles evolved a three-bone, multi-hinged lower jaw to permit swallowing large prey, but two of these three bones became an exaptation for improved hearing. The convenient location of these bones made possible the evolution of two little sound-amplifying bones inside your middle ear. No engineer would have dreamed of such an inelegant solution, which goes to illustrate the opportunistic nature of evolution. As Francis Crick once said, God is a hacker, not an engineer. I will expand on these ideas about jaw bones transforming into ear bones at the end of this chapter. Another example of a more general-purpose adaptation is the evolution of flexible fingers. Our arboreal ancestors originally evolved them for climbing trees, but hominins adapted them for fine manipulation and tool use. Today, thanks to the power of culture, fingers are a general-purpose mechanism that can be used for rocking a cradle, wielding a scepter, pointing, or even counting for math. But no one, Not even a naive adaptationist or evolutionary psychologist would argue that fingers evolved because they were selected for pointing and counting. Similarly, Gould argues, thinking may have evolved first, given its obvious usefulness in dealing with the world, which then set the stage for language. I agree with Gould's general idea that language didn't originally evolve specifically for communication, but I don't like the idea that thinking evolved first and language, by which I mean all of language, not just in the Chomskyan sense of emergence, was simply a byproduct. One reason I don't like it is that it merely postpones the problem rather than solving it. Since we know even less about thinking and how it might have evolved than we do about language, saying language evolved from thought doesn't tell us very much. As I have said many times before, you can't get very far in science by trying to explain one mystery with another mystery. The fourth idea, diametrically opposed to Gould's, was proposed by the distinguished Harvard University linguist Steven Pinker, who declares language to be an instinct, as ingrained in human nature as coughing, sneezing, or yawning. By this he doesn't mean it's as simple as these other instincts, but that it is a highly specialized brain mechanism, an adaptation that is unique to humans and that evolved through conventional mechanisms of natural selection expressly for communication. So Pinker agrees with his former teacher Chomsky in asserting, correctly I believe, that language is a highly specialized organ, but disagrees with Gould's views on the important role played by exaptation. I think there is merit to Pinker's view, but I also think his idea is far too general to be useful. It is not actually wrong, but it is incomplete. It seems a bit like saying that the digestion of food must be based on the first law of thermodynamics, which is true for sure, but it's also true for every other system on Earth. The idea doesn't tell you much about the detailed mechanisms of digestion. In considering the evolution of any complex biological system, whether the ear or the language organ, we would like to know not merely that it was done by natural selection, but exactly how it got started and then evolved to its present level of sophistication. This isn't as important for a more straightforward problem like the giraffe's neck, although even there, one wants to know how genes selectively lengthen neck vertebrae. But it is an important part of the story when you are dealing with more complex adaptations. So there you have it, four different theories of language. Of these, we can discard the first two, not because we know for sure that they are wrong, but because they can't be tested. But of the remaining two, who's right, Gould or Pinker? I'd like to suggest that neither of them is, although there's a grain of truth in each. So if you are a Gould-Pinker fan, you could say they were both right, but didn't take their arguments far enough. I would like to propose a different framework for thinking about language evolution that incorporates some features of both, but then goes well beyond them. I call it the synesthetic bootstrapping theory. As we shall see, it provides a valuable clue to understanding the origins of not only language, but also a host of other uniquely human traits, such as metaphorical thinking and abstraction. In particular, I'll argue that language and many aspects of abstract thought evolved through exaptations whose fortuitous combination yielded novel solutions. Notice that this is different from saying that language evolved from some general mechanism, such as thinking, and it also differs from Pinker's idea that language evolved as a specialized mechanism exclusively for communication. No discussion of the evolution of language would be complete without considering the question of nature versus nurture. To what extent are the rules of language innate, and to what extent are they absorbed from the world early in life? Arguments about the evolution of language have been fierce, and the nature versus nurture debate has been the most acrimonious of all. I mention it here only briefly because it has already been the subject of a number of recent books. Everyone agrees that words are not hardwired in the brain. The same object can have different names in different languages, dog in English, chien in French, kutta in Hindi, ma in Thai, and nai in Tamil, which don't even sound alike. But with regard to the rules of language, there is no such agreement. Rather, three viewpoints vie for supremacy. In the first view, the rules themselves are entirely hardwired. Exposure to adult speech is needed only to act as a switch to turn the mechanism on. The second view asserts that the rules of language are extracted statistically through listening. Bolstering this idea, artificial neural networks have been trained to categorize words and infer rules of syntax simply through passive exposure to language. While these two models certainly capture some aspect of language acquisition, they cannot be the whole story. After all, apes, house cats, and iguanas